Good evening. We're following breaking news tonight. A mass shooting in Bryan, Texas, northwest of Houston, just a few miles from Texas A&M University in College Station. It happened at a local cabinet company. The local police chief says the shooter may have been employed there. He's now in custody. Chief says at least one person has died. At least five are wounded, including a state trooper who was shot pursuing the suspect. We have a crew on the scene gathering information, and we'll bring that to you live ahead later in the hour once we know more. Today in the Derek Chauvin trial, testimony from medical and forensic experts casting yet more doubt on the notion that a drug overdose or some other existing medical condition killed George Floyd. That in a disturbing account of the man's final seconds alive. CNN's Sarah Seidner tonight reports.
That's the moment the life goes out of his body. I do.
Today, the prosecutor's expert medical witness did not hold back.
Mr. Floyd died from a low level of oxygen. And this caused damage to his brain that we see, and it also caused a PEA arrhythmia that caused his heart to stop.
The world-renowned expert on breathing and lungs, Dr. Martin Tobin, pointed to the officer's actions, saying George Floyd died because the officers created a scenario in which Floyd's lungs were put into a vice-like grip.
It was almost to the effect as if a surgeon had gone in and removed the lung. Not quite, but along those lines.
Dr. Tobin said four things caused Floyd to stop breathing, including Floyd's position on the concrete, allowing no room for his lungs to expand.
You mentioned several reasons for Mr. Floyd's low oxygen. You mentioned one, handcuffs and the street, right?
Correct.
You mentioned knee on the neck.
Yep.
Prone position.
Yep.
And then the knee on the back, arm and side. Were those the four?
Yep, these are the four.
The doctor also testified about whether drugs were the culprit that killed George Floyd. As former officer Derek Chauvin's attorney has suggested, to that, Dr. Tobin said Floyd had not taken a proper breath for 9 minutes and 50 seconds when paramedics finally got a breathing tube in him. And by that point, carbon dioxide in Floyd's body had reached lethal levels.
What's the punchline?
The significance of all of that is it's a second reason why you know fentanyl is not causing the depression of his respiration. Solely explained by what you expect to happen in somebody who doesn't have any ventilation given to him for 9 minutes and 50 seconds.
On cross-examination, Chauvin's attorney pushed Dr. Tobin on two main issues: the potential effect of drugs on Floyd's body and his breathing and his heart disease.
And that's going to affect blood flow in a person, right? It's going to make the body work a little harder to get the blood through the body.
No, not really. It's not going to do that.
How does that affect a person's respiratory?
You would expect that he would be complaining of chest pain, and you would expect that he would be demonstrating a very rapid respiratory rate. We don't see either.
The last witness of the day, also a doctor, backed up Dr. Tobin's testimony that drugs did not cause Floyd's death.
When you watch those videos and we go through them, what is his respiration? He's breathing. He's talking. He's not snoring. He is saying, you know, please, please get off of me. I want to breathe. I can't breathe. That is not a fentanyl overdose. That is somebody begging to breathe.
And Sarah Seidner joins us now from outside the courthouse. How did the jury react to the medical expert's testimony today?
They reacted particularly to Dr. Tobin, Dr. Martin Tobin there that you heard with the slight Irish accent. He was so pointed, and he at one point had the jury try different things to show them exactly sort of how breathing works and use their own hands to touch parts of their neck that he was referring to. And almost all but three jurors were doing that. And at one point, Anderson, the judge says to him and the jurors, "Now listen, you don't have to do this after an objection from the defense. You don't have to do this. You don't have to do what he says, but you can if you want." And they did continue to do exactly what Dr. Martin asked them to do. Dr. Martin Tobin, you know, in touching different parts of their neck so that they could understand exactly what he was talking about when Floyd was unable to breathe. It was pretty remarkable, Anderson.
Interesting. Sarah Seidner, appreciate it. Thanks. I want to bring in our senior legal analyst, Laura Coates, former federal prosecutor and criminal defense attorney, Mark O'Mara. So, Laura, you just heard about Sarah was talking about the prosecution's medical expert, Dr. Tobin. How effective do you think he was?
Oh, he was absolutely the most compelling witness that we've had so far. And that includes the emotional testimony that we saw from last week, from the age ranging from 9 years old to somebody more than half a century older. You've had all the law enforcement officials. No one expected this moment, as opposed to a medical examiner and autopsy, to be this captivating. But his methodical approach, his cadence, the rhythm of his information, the way in which he presented in very digestible pieces, if you didn't know what a pulmonologist was before he got up there, you certainly were following along with the demonstratives, and you were actually understanding and watching through the lens now of an expert who was pointing out different nuances, the manipulation of handcuffs, identifying the four factors that contributed to the loss of oxygen, as Sarah talked about, the definition, essentially, of torture, and this notion, this image that's indelible in my mind, Anderson, of a man reduced to trying to breathe by trying to use his knuckles, his finger, his shoulder, all to no avail, and still to have the knee on the neck and the pressure to 91 pounds on his body, on his neck. It's an image that the jury won't be able to get out of their minds either.
Mark, how effective was that? Also, to have the jury participate, and as we heard, there was an objection from the defense on that.
It was amazingly effective, because when you have a witness, or if the lawyer can be the guide for the jury, can actually walk them through an otherwise somewhat complicated series of events, then that person is going to be the guide for the jury all the way through. And what happened here was Dr. Tobin just literally became that person from the, like Laura said, the lilting voice. The Irish accent helps. But much more importantly, he actually brought them into his explanation. The hand on the neck was great, and that really got the jury involved, even with the objection. But even when he had them counting the breaths, because if you remember what he said, he goes, when you count them yourself, then you'll hear. And I will tell you, I thought that the respiration counting was one of the most specific and very interesting points of evidence, because that completely destroyed the suggestion that fentanyl and what it causes, a decrease in respiration, which is one of the high points of the defense presentation so far through cross, he completely destroyed that. And of course, other witnesses then destroyed some other possibilities of a defense. I thought this witness, as Laura said, the most compelling, because he literally walked the jury all the way through the state's case.
And Laura, it is very important what Mark said about, you know, the defense clearly is pushing, you know, potential drug use as an issue. Do you agree that Tobin did a very effective job of kind of batting that away?
He did. And here's how. You want your witness, particularly an expert witness, to establish that rapport very quickly with your jurors. They're the ones who matter. You want them, as people who are assessing and evaluating the credibility of witnesses, to be able to feel like this person is informative, not just simply trying to influence me. It's my job as the juror to ultimately be the fact finder, they say. And so I need somebody that I can trust. And so his sort of ability to not only lay out the information through the vantage point of an expert as a opposed to a layman, identifying new things, but also to address and resolve statements. Remember, there was even that moment talking about this phrase we keep hearing by Anderson, if you can talk, you can breathe. We even heard the audio body cam of Derek Chauvin making that statement, almost taunting George Floyd. Sounds like a whole lot of oxygen there for someone who can't breathe, to paraphrase his words. Well, you had him describe exactly what the human body is capable of doing, even though oxygen deprivation is imminent. He walks us through that. He walked the jury through that. But he'd already established all of the rapport and the credibility as somebody who is not a paid expert, had volunteered his services, had written the textbook on these things, and provided demonstratives, kind of like crash test dummies looking at the efficacy of an airbag. He was able to have people in the moment visualizing it. These jurors were no longer flies on the wall seeing it through the eyes of bystanders. They were participants. That's exactly where you want to be as a prosecutor.
Mark, you thought the defense actually missed a few opportunities today.
I really thought they did, because I think they allowed Tobin to go way beyond his area of expertise. I thought that they should have been objecting to a lot more of what Tobin was saying. He is a pulmonologist. He's a great one. He can talk about breath. He can talk about respiration. But when he starts talking about everything else that he did to give the state the best evidence that they could, again, destroying the idea of the fentanyl intoxication, even the meth intoxication, I thought that the defense should have really honed him in a lot more, particularly when you have such an effective witness, because you have to try and at least interrupt the flow, interrupt the cadence. And I thought the defense just sort of got lulled to sitting there listening to how intriguing he was. And I also want to say that I thought the state did a masterful job through this witness of leaving the knee on neck sort of behind a little bit, again, because it was questionable. Is the knee really on the neck the whole time? All of that's there. They shifted from knee on neck to just full body on body compression. Mm. And I think that is really what caused the death. We now know that to believe Dr. Toobin. And I think that was a great way to sort of move over to something that they can truly justify rather than just the knee on neck.
Mark O'Mara, Laura Coates, appreciate it. We're joined next by George Floyd's cousin. Talk about what she and other family members think about the trial thus far. And later, a live update from the shooting scene in Bryan, Texas. The suspect is in custody. At least one person we know has died. We'll have details on that. And Congressman Matt Gaetz facing potentially damaging news tonight. His indicted friend could be getting ready to make a deal and cooperate with prosecutors. It's a difficult testimony for anyone to watch and hear today at the Derek Chauvin trial, especially when it's close to George Floyd. Joining us now is Sherita Tate, his cousin and president of the George Floyd Foundation. Sherita, thanks for being with us. First of all, how are you and your family doing during this trial?
I think we're doing about as well as you can expect. You know, the opening arguments was a very tough time for us because it was a time for many where we had to kind of relive the video again. For me, it was the first time actually seeing it. But I think we're managing as well as you can expect at this point.
It was the first time you'd watched the video. That's interesting.
Yes. The first time that the video was sent to me, I actually only listened to maybe 15, 20 seconds of it. I heard his voice, and that was confirmation for me that it was actually Perry. So I did not watch it again.
It was just too painful to watch.
It was too painful to watch. It was painful to actually hear his cries out. Him crying out was painful. So I couldn't even imagine allowing myself to actually watch it.
I know before the trial started, you said you were pessimistically optimistic about what would happen in court. I'm wondering how you feel now.
Well, I mean, I thought today was a good day for the prosecution and for us in hearing the testimony from the doctor who, you know, sort of reiterated what we've known all along is that his death was from him not being able to actually breathe and not a drug overdose as has been tried. They've been trying to allude to. So, pessimistically optimistic was just my position because, you know, we've seen this time and time again. Where the outcome is not what we would like to have happen. So while I think I see some very good points on our side, I still reserve the right to say that it's a foregone conclusion that we'll get a conviction.
Are you pleased is the right word, but you think the prosecution is working well?
I think so. I think Mr. Blackwell, I really like the way that, you know, the opening statement was done. It really, for me, kind of spelled it out, you know, line by line. We had a good view of what the whole process was, you know, watching the tape, breaking it down for us. I thought that he did an amazing job with that. And then all of the witness to come back and just kind of support what he laid out in the beginning. So I feel good about what the prosecution is doing.
What do you hope comes out of this trial? I mean, obviously, this is a pursuit of for justice for George Floyd, for your family. On a larger picture, you know, so many people are watching this trial. hearing all the evidence, thinking about these issues, and I'm wondering if there's a larger, something larger that you hope comes out of it.
Well, most definitely, like you said, you know, we had from the very onset had two things in mind. One, that there would be conviction for all of the officers involved in the murder of George. And then also that we would see some true change take place. And so I think the climate that we're in right now, from his death being the catalyst for the movement we've seen all over the world with people, you know, protesting and pushing for some change. So I think for us, you know, not having his death being in vain and actually seeing some change for generations to come is what we'd hope to see.
I know you're working for that with the George Floyd Foundation. I really appreciate your time tonight, and I wish you well in the days ahead.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Sherita Tate. Coming up next, we'll have an update on the breaking news out of Texas. We told you about the top of the program. Another mass shooting happened at a workplace northwest of Houston. A live report when we continue. We're now in the breaking news out of Texas, where there's been yet another mass shooting. At least one person is dead, five others wounded, including a Texas state trooper. Our Ed Lavandera is there. So what happened, Ed?
Hi, Anderson. Well, this shooting took place in this business complex on the north side of Bryan, Texas. Back over those trees that you see over there, police have cordoned off that area. Investigators say this afternoon what they believe to be an employee walked into the cabinet manufacturing business here in Bryan and started shooting. One employee described to a local affiliate here in Bryan that it sounded as if some of the machinery was having issues, and then that's when everybody inside the business started to run. In the end here, one person was killed, five others wounded. Four of those that have been wounded, we are told, are in critical condition tonight. And the gunman was able to get away from the scene before officers arrived and was then pursued into a neighboring county. And that is where it's believed that the gunman also fired and hit a state trooper that was pursuing him in that neighboring county. We are told that that state trooper is in serious but stable condition tonight. Police here in Bryan, Anderson, say they believed the suspect used a handgun in this shooting, but they do not know at this point what the motive might be or what set him off at this point. They are not releasing his name yet, but they continue to work the scene here behind me in Bryan, Texas. Anderson?
So at this point, they don't know a motive, or at least they're not saying of one.
They do not know a motive, that at least that they're not saying anything publicly. They are continuing to interview witnesses and employees at the business. The police chief here in Bryan did say that the gunman was an employee of the business. It's not clear if he was a current employee or a former employee, but definitely had some sort of connection to this cabinet manufacturing business here in Bryan.
All right. Ed Lavandera, I appreciate it. Thank you. The shooting came only a few hours after President Biden announced a series of executive actions on guns after a wave of other mass shootings that he said were, quote, a blemish on the nation. The president referenced yet another mass shooting that happened yesterday afternoon. A South Carolina doctor, his wife, and two of their grandchildren were killed in their home. Authorities today said a former NFL player was the suspect and that he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Among the measures announced today was one to restrict so-called ghost guns, weapons that can be built from parts and instructions purchased online. He once again called on Congress to pass stronger legislation.
Whether Congress acts or not, I'm going to use all the resources at my disposal as president to keep the American people safe from gun violence. But there's much more that Congress can do to help that effort. And they can do it right now. They've offered plenty of thoughts and prayers, members of Congress, but they passed not a single new federal law to reduce gun violence. Enough prayers. Time for some action.
Joining me now is Georgia Representative Lucy McBath, whose 17-year-old son was shot and killed back in 2012 while sitting in a car with a group of friends at a gas station. Congresswoman McBath, I appreciate you being with us. You ran for Congress in part because of the killing of your son in 2012. With today's executive actions, do you think the president is moving fast enough when it comes to gun control?
Well, what I know is that President Biden understands the pain of losing someone. And it was definitely apparent in the Rose Garden today as he spoke directly to survivors like myself and advocates. He made it clear that this administration, his administration, is willing to fight to keep all of our families safe. And of course, we know that this is a problem that is going to take some time to dampen. It's going to take some time to create an environment in which people feel safe in their communities. And so everything that he's doing is tangible. These are tangible actions that we know right now are building a really strong foundation, of course, which Congress, we have to build upon this foundation. But these are tangible efforts that he's willing to put, you know, forth right now, he and Vice President Harris, to make sure that we're keeping our families safe.
Obviously, as a candidate, President Biden made a lot of promises around gun reform legislation, from reinstating an assault weapons ban to repealing liability protections for gun manufacturers. Obviously, he hasn't moved on those proposals. And given what, you know, the situation he's in, you know, his position that legislating is, quote, a matter of timing. How patient are you willing to be?
In this culture of gun violence, which has been building and building for years, Anderson, it is going to take some time. It is not going to happen overnight. And every piece of policy that we put forth, every move that we make, everything that we do each and every single day is building a culture for safer communities. And he's acting to save lives. But Congress, we are the ones that have to act. We're the ones that are responsible and accountable for our constituents. So it's up to us to do right by Americans and put forth these life-saving measures. That's our responsibility.
Do you have any hope of Congress actually doing anything?
Yes, I do. The fact that I was able to lead a letter with my colleagues that we were able to appropriate and secure $25 million to study the effects of gun violence, do that research, collect that data to substantiate the policies that we need to put forth to save lives. We are moving forward. But, you know, sometimes we have to lose forward, but we are moving forward, and we're building a community of activists and movement builders on the ground, and, you know, gun violence prevention organizations and my colleagues that are not willing to lay down on this. Mm-hmm. We are not giving up.
Well, Congresswoman McBath, I appreciate your time, and I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ahead, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin sits with CNN for an exclusive interview about his relationship with President Biden and the control he now has over the president's agenda in a divided Senate. And later, a dramatic turn in a case that could have a direct impact on the federal probe of Congressman Matt Gaetz, what attorneys for an associate of Gaetz, who's currently sitting in jail, said today when we continue. In a case that's closely tied to the fate of Congressman Matt Gaetz, federal prosecutors and a defense attorney for an associate of Gaetz made a pretty stunning revelation in court today. One that could have direct bearing on the federal probe of the Republican congressman and allegations about whether he broke sex trafficking and prostitution laws. CNN's Paula Reed tonight was in the courtroom, now has details.
Tonight, the investigation surrounding Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz enters a new phase as a key associate signals he might strike a plea deal with the government.
It really is an honor to be here today.
Joel Greenberg, a friend of Gaetz and the former tax collector in Seminole County, Florida, is likely to enter a deal in his own criminal case, raising the possibility he could cooperate with investigators as part of the deal.
I'm sure Matt Gaetz is not feeling very comfortable today.
Greenberg's attorney was in court today and said any potential for cooperation would be worked out in conjunction with a plea deal.
If somebody signs a cooperation agreement, they're required to cooperate.
Gaetz's friendship with Greenberg is key to the federal investigation surrounding him. The two have been friends for years, posting photos together. Gaetz even told a local radio station in 2017 that Greenberg would make a good member of Congress.
Joel Greenberg has gone into the Seminole County Tax Collector's Office. He's taken it by storm. He's been a disruptor.
The plea deal is not finalized, but if the agreement goes through, it means one of Gaetz's close confidants would be cooperating with the government, putting further pressure on the congressman.
Mr. Greenberg, if he accepts a plea or a plea agreement, one, it will show his sense of remorse, which he does have, and his sense of acceptance of responsibility. Number two, I think he's uniquely situated.
Greenberg has been awaiting trial in jail after violating the terms of his bail earlier this year. He is charged with 33 criminal counts, including allegations of stalking and harassing a political opponent. Also included, one count of sex trafficking a child between the ages of 14 and 17. While details in the court records for this charge are scant, investigators believe Greenberg recruited multiple women online for sex and that he introduced the women, who received cash payments, to Gates, who had sex with them too, according to the New York Times. Gates has denied all allegations, writing on Monday, "I have never, ever paid for sex. And second, I, as an adult man, have not slept with a 17-year-old.
Providing for flights and hotel rooms for people that you're dating who are of legal age is not a crime."
But a source tells CNN investigators are examining whether any federal campaign money was involved in paying for travel and expenses for the women. And now, federal investigators are scrutinizing a trip Gates took to the Bahamas and whether women were paid to travel for sex with a congressman and others, a potential federal crime, sources tell CNN. As part of a broader probe, investigators want to know if Gates was accepting paid escorts and travel in exchange for political favors, according to people familiar with the investigation. Gates' lawyers declined to comment, but a spokesman for Gates denied the allegations to CBS News, calling them part of a general fishing exercise about vacations and consensual relationships with adults. Paula Reed, CNN, Orlando.
Well, let's get some perspective now from Norm Eisen, former ethics czar for the Obama White House and a CNN legal analyst, and back with us, CNN senior legal analyst Laura Coates. So, Ambassador Eisen, you heard Paula. If prosecutors are thinking about offering Joel Greenberg a plea deal, what does it say to you about their case so far?
Anderson, thanks for having me back. It says to me that Mr. Greenberg must have something very serious, given the nature of the charges against him. In order to get a plea deal, he's going to have to give something up. And based on all the evidence that we know publicly, it looks like evidence against Congressman Matt Gaetz is that thing that he's going to need to trade for.
And Laura, when in a plea deal situation, I assume prosecutors know what is on the table, what is being offered? I mean, they know the range
Absolutely.
Of what somebody can testify to.
They will know the foundation for why the person's willing to sort of scratch my back, if you scratch mine, et cetera, I scratch yours. But the idea here, it could be a much wider net that's cast. Once the plea deal arrangement, in other words, a cooperation agreement, is out there, then you have the opportunity to delve in even deeper. There may be other people, bigger fish, smaller fish, just a wider net being cast. But remember, agreeing to sign a cooperation deal does not end your obligations to the federal government. That's where the story really begins. And until you've actually been sentenced, you're on the hook for providing information throughout that. And sometimes cooperation agreements don't end until you've actually provided the testimony that you have said you're going to provide. You've backed up the information in some way, and sometimes can often lead to a conviction. It can be very broad to secure that if the government's going to drop the, 33 felony charges against you or reduce it in any way, you better have something to show for it, because prosecutors don't just bring cases based on a hunch. They already have the evidence when they have the indictment.
Norm, I mean, after the hearing today, Greenberg's attorney said, quote, "I'm sure Matt Gaetz is not feeling very comfortable today." We showed that clip. It's kind of a snarky thing to say for an attorney. I'm not quite sure I understand the strategy of saying it, whether there's maybe there's no strategy at all. But is not sure why he would kind of want to particularly worry Matt Gaetz if there isn't even yet a signed plea deal.
Anderson, it was a miscue. That is not best practice for a defense lawyer. The best thing to do, and I've done it for decades, and in representing individuals, the best thing to do is to be very neutral until that deal is done. Prosecutors will look askance at that kind of grandstanding. But that being said, I think the intent was to signal to the world what I'm sure Mr. Greenberg's lawyers have been saying to the government: we can give you Matt Gaetz. And part of what's going on now is they're proffering, as we put it, sharing evidence. And ultimately, the government will want to sit down with Mr. Greenberg himself before they do a cooperation agreement, before they do a plea, to see if that inartful statement is true and how Mr. Greenberg presents.
And Laura, there's, I mean, given the number of charges against against this guy Greenberg, any sense of how many charges could, I mean, what kind of an impact a plea deal would have on his potential sentencing?
Well, normally it would be in a plea agreement, even with this scope of charges, there might be some that they're willing to reduce in terms of either what they're going to ask for of a sentence if they do plead guilty, or reduce the number of charges, or even as a possibility, you could have a multiple number of convictions, but ask for a sentence to actually run what they call concurrently, meaning it's not going to be back to back to back to back. So you'd be able to get the wide scope of charges. But there's also signals to a lot of people here, to Norm's point, maybe who is not being asked to cooperate. And sometimes when the defense is trying to tell the world, hey, here's who we have information on, it might signal who the government is interested in finding out information about and who does not, who is not in the good graces. What you're seeing here is the persona non grata who's starting to form here, and it appears to be Congressman Gates. But again, just saying in front of a camera, prosecutors need more. It's more than innuendo, more than insinuation. They want evidence, and likely they want corroboration on what they may or may not already have.
Norm, it's so interesting that Congressman Gates chooses to fundraise off, I mean, I don't know how interesting it is. I mean, it's probably, this is what they do. But the fact, I mean, I don't know if it's like chutzpah or what, but the fact that he's fundraising off of this, I mean, generally you would think if somebody is, you know, facing potential charges and investigation and they're the person they've been palling around with and doing all sorts of things with is in jail and potentially going to give a plea deal, they might just be a little humble.
Well,
or at least just quiet.
Anderson, having worked on the House Judiciary Committee when Congressman Gates was a member, I can tell you that humility is the last thing that will come his way. But it's not smart for his exposure. He has been all over the map making public statements about this. He's decided to try it in the court of opinion, public opinion. You know, he's taken the wrong lessons from his role model, ex-President Trump. Here, every statement he's made is potentially incriminating and can work against him.
Yeah. Norm Eisen, Laura Coates, appreciate it. Thank you. Up next, how a mother took down the Ku Klux Klan after the lynching of her son.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.